What began as a third-rate burglary brought down a presidency and forced the resignation of a man who was re-elected to that office only 2 years before with one of the largest electoral margins in history. It was one of the most traumatic moments in American history. Here to provide a 25-year retrospective on the Watergate affair is Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik and his guest, Stanley Cutler.
Thank you, Brian. August 9th is the 25th anniversary of the emotional departure of Richard Nixon from the White House. Here to put the Watergate crisis and the Nixon tapes in historical perspective is Stanley Cutler, professor of American institutions at the University of Wisconsin and the author of two books on the subject, The Wars of Watergate and his most recent, Abuse of Power, The New Nixon Tapes, published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome, Professor Cutler.
Hello there.
Let's begin with the obvious. Why did Richard Nixon resign?
Well, Richard Nixon resigned 25 years ago as the culmination of what had been a 16-month assault on his presidency and an inquiry into his personal behavior. This was not a one-time affair, one shot, a one incident. This was as a result of the accumulation of evidence over a period of a year on various charges of abuse of presidential power and of obstruction of justice. And finally, the House Judiciary Committee hit him with a contempt article of impeachment as a result. The House Judiciary Committee had voted impeachment in July 1974. A few days later, we got the revelations of the so-called smoking gun tape that explicitly involved Nixon in an attempt to cover up the White House involvement with the Watergate burglars and to utilize the CIA to quash the FBI investigation. This was the final blow to many of his supporters within the Republican Party. Indeed, on following the revelation of the smoking gun tape, Barry Goldwater, certainly a highly regarded leader of the Republican Party, led a delegation of Republican congressmen, the leaders in the House and in the Senate, to call on Nixon and to visit Nixon and call on him to resign. When Nixon said in his resignation speech that I have lost my political base in Congress, he meant, of course, his own party. And there just was, by August 9, 1974, an overwhelming political consensus in the United States within the political bodies in Washington itself, and I think throughout the country, that agreed that it was time for Richard Nixon to leave.
Mm-hmm. Now, resign. We've just gone through this process with President Clinton.
Right.
And the argument with Nixon. I mean, is this a viable constitutional procedure?
Well, I was struck during the whole Clinton process with the ironic parallels or lack of parallels with Watergate. First of all, I think we've got to say that one of the biggest losers in the recent impeachment imbroglio was Richard Nixon. The Democrats insisted that President Clinton's actions did not reach the critical stage that Nixon's had in Watergate. And meanwhile, the Republicans in Congress were saying that Clinton's acts were as bad as Watergate. Either way, it wound up damning Richard Nixon, and alas, poor Richard was the loser in all that. Well, you know that when the Clinton story broke, or I should say the Monica story broke, and then there was in August of 98, there was the special prosecutor Ken Starr's report on Clinton, there was a hue and cry throughout the country that Clinton resign. 150 newspapers called for his resignation. Prominent like David Broder and prominent public intellectuals like Gary Wills called for his resignation. They found him a totally embarrassing man who no longer could function the presidency. Well, first of all, he could function. But most of all, he resisted this, and I'm glad that he did, because I think that if we had turned resignation into a common occurrence, it would have resulted in a profound change in the nature of our government. Now, I have no quarrel with the parliamentary system, but we don't have a parliamentary system. And if we don't like what a president does at a particular moment, that should not be enough to bring him down. I mean, if it is, then we got the process of impeachment, which was invoked this time. So I think that, that Clinton's not resigning was a good thing. Now, Nixon, on the other hand, is a different story. I said before that this was the culmination of a process that had really gone on since, well, you could date it from February 1973, when the Senate unanimously passes a resolution empowering the Ervin Committee, the Senate Select Committee on Campaign Practices. And that committee meets, and then in May, the special prosecutor is authorized, and then in October, the House votes an impeachment inquiry, and for 8 months, they conducted inquiry. There was nothing instant or sudden about all this. This worked out over a long period of time. And then I think it just, the decision to have Nixon resign was a consensual matter, and it was a moment of relief for the country. And I think a very, very unique moment in our history.
Mm-hmm. Now, the title of your book is Abuse of Power. Mm-hmm. I mean, how was power abused?
Well,
I mean, what's in, especially in comparing it with Clinton?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, abuse of power is the category of those tapes that's dictated by congressional law. I did not so name them. I just found it convenient to use it for the book, because these tapes all are dealing with President Nixon's so-called abuses of power. That is, his attempts to use federal agencies to violate the law, to do things that, like, for example, to get the CIA to cover up, help him cover up the commission of the Watergate crime, things like that that are involved there. But, you know, we talk about the creation of the plumbers, which was an extra legal body designed to break into people's offices and homes and gather material incriminating or unfavorable to that individual that the administration might use, as they did in the break-in of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. So this was considered to be an abuse of power.
Mm-hmm. Well, once the actual act of Watergate itself was made known to the president, I mean, why do you think he participated in the cover-up of that Watergate break-in?
Well, the only thing that makes sense, well, first of all, we do know that he helped cover it up, including approving payments of hush money to the burglars, so as the burglars would not implicate the people in his administration that they had worked with. Now, how much Richard Nixon actually knew of the specific commission of the Watergate break-in is open to some debate. It is known, however, that quite regularly in this period and before, he had been urging Haldeman and his aides to get intelligence, information on the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Larry O'Brien, to find out more about his opponents and so forth. And he would say this repeatedly to his primary aide, H.R. Haldeman, and Haldeman had his own man in the president's committee, in the committee to reelect the president. That was Jeb Magruder, who undoubtedly passed it on to Gordon Liddy, who devised this crazy plan, and so forth. So, I mean, Nixon's involvement in the actual break-in is not crystal clear at this time, at any rate. But it is, I think, quite clear by implication. But what is clear explicitly is his role in the cover-up. Now, you know, when you ask why the cover-up, I mean, you know, he wants a cover-up. Yeah, he's approving the payment of hush money to the burglars so they keep quiet about the people in his administration. But the fact is, there were things aside from Watergate that he did not want talked about. For example, the plumbers. Don't forget, some of the burglars there were involved as part of the plumbers. And, you know, Nixon's own attorney general and his good friend, John Mitchell, referred to the White House horrors, by which he meant, as he said in his testimony, things that had gone on in his first term, and Nixon and his aides were anxious not be revealed so as not to embarrass him during the 1972 campaign. So it's more than just Watergate. It's things that went on in the first term. For example, the plumbers at Ellsberg's psychiatrist, the break-in of Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office.
Now, I can remember as a young graduate student when I first learned of these tapes, and in conversation with fellows, we just looked at each other and laughed and said, we'll never hear these, he'll burn them.
That's right.
Why, one of the anomalies of history, why do you think Nixon didn't destroy the tapes since they were so incriminating?
Well, your query when you were younger was quite correct. Even when we found out about the existence of the tapes, it was not likely at that moment that we would get to hear them. Well, you ask the obvious question, why doesn't he destroy the tapes? Well, the question is, why does he have a taping system? Before you to answer your question, you have to ask the other one. He had a taping system because he's convinced he needs a complete record, as complete as possible, of the history of his administration, primarily so he can have his version of history to use against others. Remember, those tapes are never going to be public. He's going to use them. Now, you can bet that some of those tapes are contrived. For example, they'll sit there and devise a scenario. Haldeman and Nixon will sit there and devise some scenario. Oh, I didn't know about this. I didn't know about that. Yet if you listen to the conversation a day earlier, they're talking about this and that. But this is the one they would be willing to let the public hear. Well, look, on such and such a date, we had a conversation. We didn't know anything about this. But then he's also going to use it, as he says in his memoirs. The reason why he didn't want to destroy the tapes was because he wanted to have his version of history against others. Now, when the existence of the tapes is announced, it was a very good bet those things would never be public. But what happened is that over a year's period of time, that the evidence built up so that the special prosecutor was able to make a compelling case to the Supreme Court that these particular conversations showed a possible criminal involvement of the White House. And the Supreme Court said that there is no absolute executive privilege and ordered the tapes released.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you say, the administration was probably thinking these tapes would never become public. Now, it actually did take quite some time. And eventually, for you to get the tapes, to be able to turn them into transcripts of a book, it took an act of Congress and 20 years of lawsuits. Why was that?
Not quite. Congress passed the law immediately mandating the release of these things and specifying that the abuse of power ones had to come first. But then Nixon just stonewalled it. He kept delaying it. And when I sued in 1992, I sued the National Archives, which had the materials. Nixon intervened in the case. And I have no doubt that if Richard Nixon were alive at this very moment, we would still not have the tapes. He would have fought with all the resources at his command because he simply did not want to face the embarrassment and the revelations that those tapes have caused and will continue to cause. Because, we have a schedule over the next number of years of the further release of another 3,000 hours. They're there, and I simply sued to get their released and finally was successful mm-hmm. in that.
Now, I remember the glowing eulogies at Nixon's funeral mm-hmm. a couple of years ago. What do you think the publication of the transcripts of the tapes will have on Nixon's long-term historical stature?
Well, let me answer that without just talking about the tapes in general. You know, it was at Nixon's funeral that President Clinton, like Nixon before him, said the time has come to judge Richard Nixon apart from Watergate. Well, let me make two comments on that. One is, to quote Shakespeare, Watergate is the spot that will not out, or to paraphrase Shakespeare, Watergate is the spot will not out in Nixon's career. How can you escape this? The most compelling fact of Richard Nixon's presidency is that he resigned because of scandal. I think that's just unassailable. Now, Nixon always asked, and so did Clinton, that he be evaluated also with the deeds of his presidency. Fair enough. Fair enough. And slowly but surely, a lot of the documentary material is coming out dealing with that. Yet if you look at the works that are the scholarly works that are being published, there's one on the history of his foreign policy. There's one on the Vietnam War in particular. There is one, a very good one, on his economic and fiscal policies. And in all of them, the administration's record is seen in a very negative light. This has nothing to do with Watergate, except that Watergate eventually did permeate those subjects, because by 1973, Nixon operated with Watergate on his mind almost to the exclusion of anything else. Everything he did had an enormous political calculus after that. But I think that these new works are very serious criticisms of his administration, but he will continue to be evaluated in ways other than Watergate. But I think we come back to the central fact that Richard Nixon, comma, the 37th president of the United States, comma, became the first president to resign because of scandal. That's what the history books always will say.
Okay.
As time goes on, history becomes more and more compressed. A century from now, there'll be a lot less interest in Richard Nixon, and he'll get maybe one or two sentences in a book. The first sentence, or the first half of the only sentence, will be what I just said.
Yes. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have.
Well, it was a pleasure.
I thank our guest, Stanley Cutler of the University of Wisconsin, and the author of Abuse of Power, published by Simon & Schuster.
One of the best sources of information on the Watergate affair, as we just heard, is the Nixon tapes. But there are also Kennedy and Johnson tapes, and here to discuss all three in our op-ed of the week is Bruce Shulman, Professor of History and Director of American Studies at Boston University. Professor Shulman is the author of Lyndon B. Johnson and American Liberalism, published in 1994 by Bedford Books of St. Martin's Press.
A quarter century ago, one of the bit players in the Watergate drama, Nixon aide Alexander Butterfield, let slip the existence of the White House tapes, a voice-activated system that secretly recorded all conversations in the Oval Office. Butterfield's revelation electrified the nation, generating outrage that Nixon had taped aides and rivals without their knowledge or consent. In an effort to calm the uproar, the White House immediately revealed that Nixon had not been alone. Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy had also recorded meetings and phone conversations in the Oval Office and the Cabinet Room. Today, all of these recordings, once secreted in vaults and warehouses, are slowly becoming public. The public has greeted the release of these recordings with excitement. ABC News even devoted several episodes of Nightline to dramatic reenactments of the Nixon and Johnson tapes. But professional historians, reliant as they are on more mundane and less certain sources of evidence, have been decidedly less enthusiastic. First, the tapes do not and cannot speak for themselves. Without independent knowledge of the historical context, they make little sense. In one conversation, Johnson told Georgia Senator Richard Russell that he believed the conspiracy underlay the Kennedy assassination. Does that recording reveal his real feelings? Or was he only trying to convince the reluctant Russell to join the Warren Commission? The tapes alone don't tell. Second, the recordings hardly constitute a frank, unguarded record of intimate conversations in the Oval Office. Kennedy turned the equipment on and off with a switch, preserving only those elements of conversation he desired. Johnson and Nixon knew the tapes were running and used them to protect their political backsides. For instance, Nixon and top aide H.R. Haldeman spoke for the machines when they deliberately strained to discredit their accuser, John Dean. Finally, the new material merely buttresses prevailing interpretations. In no way does it alter historians' fundamental understanding of these presidencies. The Johnson transcripts, for example, vividly illustrate LBJ's famed political genius and document his well-known uncertainty about what he called that bitch of a war in Vietnam. The Nixon tapes document a greater level of culpability than previously expected, and a wider range of White House horrors, from discussions about blowing the safe at the Brookings Institution to shaking down campaign contributors for ambassadorships. but their ultimate message confirms what we already knew. Nixon was a crook. In his final days, Lyndon Johnson pressed his secretary to prevent the early release of his White House recordings. As far as he was concerned, most of them should remain sealed forever. Nixon fought the publication of his tapes until his death. Both men feared the pitiless exposure of recorded conversations. Audio and video seemingly turn scholars into eavesdroppers. They appear to create a direct, unmediated experience of history, without bias, without censorship, without interpretation. Americans have largely embraced this view, this sense that the truth is what is captured on tape, and only what is captured on tape. But the riches and the dangers of the presidential tapes remind us to resist that idea. There is more to history than is revealed in these secret recordings.
You've been listening to Bruce Shulman, Professor of History and Director of American Studies at Boston University.